invited him along. That was kind of following on from what Padraig said about knowing me for a while and still came here. Cole is a journalist. You were on staff at The Independent, weren't you? Yeah, there you go, 15 years. Interviewer of the year last year. Has recently moved into a different broadcasting career. He produced a series on Radio 4 about the boy who lost his heart or something. The boy who gave his heart away, which is his first ever radio documentary, which also won an award straight away. So he's a very talented man. He's very provocative. And I hope that you will enjoy what he has to say. And I think he's going to get you involved in some things as well. So thank you very much. Cole Morton.
Thank you. Thank you. Provocative. Well, I've got to live up to that, haven't I? It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. I was delighted, actually, to see... where is he? Someone who educated my children, all of my children. Mark Trott, lovely man and a great teacher. So it's great to see you here, Mark. And thanks. So, I meet with some people once a month, on the first Saturday of the month, for a thing called Wild Spirit, which is, we call it an attempt to encounter the sacred in the open air. And some of us come from a Christian background, some of us don't. Some come from a pagan background, some come from other religions and none. Two or three of us who lead it are firmly within the Christian tradition, but it's the attempt is to host and to be welcoming and to allow everyone to facilitate. And when we start something, we only have three lines that we like to say together. And I'm going to invite you to say them together this morning with me. They're pretty easy. The first line is, we are here because we want to be. Can you agree with that? Mostly. A couple of raised eyebrows, potentially in couples, I can see that. The second one is, we recognize where we are. Because part of what we do at Wild Spirit is to become aware of our surroundings and see what we can learn from that. We recognize where we are. And the third line is, we're grateful for it. So if you don't mind, and you don't have to do this clearly, but if you don't mind, I'll say those lines and I'll invite you to repeat them back to me. So we are here because we want to be. We are here because we want to be. We recognize where we are. And we're grateful for it. And as part of settling in together for this next time as we share some ideas, I'd like to just play a couple of minutes of the tune that was playing as you came in, which is a fabulous song by Ian Archer, who's a local, I think, called Everest, a song that helped me through a lot of things. And it has this amazing refrain at the end, some other day, when my morning comes, I'll be the one who waited all night. It's a wonderful song of longing. What I'd invite you to do, just as we listen to it, is just to experience through your senses where you are. So what we do in Wild Spirit is we think about our bodies, how we feel, our feet rooted in the ground, what we can smell, what we can taste, what we can hear, and what we can see around us. So just for these 3 minutes, I'd invite us all to sit together and do that collectively so that we get a sense of where we are, and then we begin. Is that okay? Great.
Summer day, when my
I hope that gives us a sense, just taking those couple of minutes out, of being at ease in this space with this lovely barista-style heaters. It makes me want to order a flat white straight away. And it makes me wish I hadn't given up smoking. because belonging and community and being together is part of what I want to talk about tonight. It's part of what we're looking for. One day when my morning comes, I'll be the one who waited all night. It's dark, but morning comes. The silver star was shining above Bethlehem because morning had to come. That's the Reverend Jesse Jackson. We've all got that longing in us for home, for belonging, and yet somehow we're restless. We're looking for clues. So, Martin asked me to come and speak, and I said no. And then I wrote him a long email. Well, let me quote you a couple of paragraphs from it, if I may. This is what I wrote. Right now, it feels like Christian is a rude word. Christianity is a toxic brand. I should explain, this was just after Donald Trump had been elected with an 81% vote from white evangelicals. It was also around the time that the bishops were beginning to talk about their report about sexuality, both of which things were agitating me. It's become a byword, I wrote, for an idea of faith that supports capitalist greed, warmongering, oppression of difference, and breathtaking bigotry. This is nothing new, of course. It's happened through history. But I don't want to wear that badge anymore. I want to speak out against my own. And yet, I believe. Still, I can't help it. This is my story. Christ is my guide. This is my tradition and path, the one I fell into by accident of birth and instinct, and my way to divine truth while recognizing the wisdom of others. And I know there are some people, I talked about Jim Wallace and Sojourners in America, and the leaders in different places who speak out for a different kind of incarnation with values I'm drawn to. I know you know this, Martin, I wrote. I'm just thinking aloud about why I shouldn't just walk out on the church, which is what I really want to do. But where else do I go, Lord? What is there to do beyond self-loathing? We all face that issue now, those of us who can't help but care. That's what I wrote to turn down this invitation from Martin, a man I admire, and his response was, fine, come and say that. So be careful how you respond to him, I'd suggest. I wasn't born into faith, I was born into atheism. Atheist socialism with a distant smattering of Salvation Army and a healthy disrespect for the church. And then I was converted at the age of 19, spectacularly, bells and whistles, the whole package, tongues, signs and wonders, demons and angels. And I'm not going to gainsay that. Things happened then that I didn't understand, and I still don't, but I know that they did happen. And I became convinced during that time that there was a God, a spiritual force at work in the world, but something didn't hang together. It was something about the simplicity of the story that we were telling versus the complexity of real life. Hope against history, as somebody put it. For example, not everyone was healed when we prayed for them. That's a pretty familiar situation for all of us, and yet some people are. And on the other hand, there was the simplicity of the story of Jesus and the words that he spoke versus the complexity of the worldwide institution of the church. And I, for a couple of years, was a missionary working in refugee camps in Asia and Africa. And I became aware over that time that there was a transaction going on that I found I couldn't be part of. which was essentially, you come to us, we will heal you, we will feed you, we will clothe you, but you must sign up. That didn't seem to me to be the way it was supposed to be. And then, in the midst of all this, we were trying to have a baby. We spent 7 years trying to have a baby, and it wasn't working. And if any of you have been through the fertility process, you'll know that it's a terrible, racking thing that shatters relationships, destroys your confidence, and turns you into different people, and also reveals truths about you. And in the middle of that experience, I had, to paraphrase Wesley, my heart was strangely chilled. I had an anti-conversion experience. I went to church on Christmas Eve, 1996. And the text was, "Unto us a child is born." And I heard that text like a slap in the face, thinking, okay, you're supposed to be the God, the divine force, the creator spirit at work in the world, and you can't even do this for us. And so I walked out. And you know what? This would be a very different story if it was as simple as that. But it wasn't as simple as that, because I couldn't let go. And a year later, a child was born. My son, Jacob. And there was an Ash Wednesday service that I wandered along to reluctantly, and I was holding the child in my arms, and I was rocking him backwards and forwards, and I was thinking, I can't make sense of this. I can't make sense whether this child is a miracle of faith or a miracle of science. And it became a kind of prayer, even though at that stage I was intent on telling you that I didn't believe. Is this a miracle of faith or is it a miracle of science? And in the way that some of us do, sometimes we perceive a voice to speak in our minds, and we don't know if it's the voice of God or it's the voice of our own mind, but it's there anyway, it's incontrovertible. And this voice said, in answer to the question, is it a miracle of science or a miracle of faith? Yes. Really helpful. And then I became a reporter on the Church Times. Now, if you want to test your faith, I strongly advise you to go into being a reporter on the Church Times. Particularly at that period, it was during a period of argument about what the church should be investing in, which to this day remains baffling. But at that point, Church of England was just becoming aware that it was investing in hawks that were being sold to Indonesia to support an oppressive regime. And to this day, the Church of England still allows itself, despite establishing an ethical committee, still allows itself to invest in companies that make money from guns, pornography, and high interest rates. And the get-out clause is, as long as the main percentage of earnings in that company are not those things. So, for example, it might invest in a credit card company, let's say Barclaycard, and Barclaycard's worldwide global income might be so vast that the amount of money that it earns, say, from pornography sites is 5%. Well, the Church of England's threshold is 10%, which means that the Church of England can invest in a company that invests millions, even perhaps billions, or earns that money through something that the church opposes. It's a complicated world, right? Nothing's easy. And so what do we do if we're people of faith to try and support ourselves in that? We create circles. Circles of belonging. So I don't know about you, but I've got some friends, and we have arguments, but we do, generally speaking, agree with each other, and we support each other, and we go to the same kind of gigs, and we read the same kind of books, and we talk about the same kind of stuff, and sometimes we go to the same churches. A bit like on Facebook, you've got your echo chamber of friendship on Facebook, and that supports you. So that's your circle, and then around that, You've got your wider circle, your church, your club, your pastimes, the kind of media information that you allowed in. Are you a Guardian reader? Are you a Mail reader? Are you any kind of reader? And within those circles, we tell ourselves that we're looking beyond, because we can look back to the source of our faith. Now, for Christians, that's relatively easy, because particularly for evangelical Christians, we're told that we can have a direct, personal, intimate relationship with Jesus Christ and with God through Jesus. So we look back and we say, okay, I'm fixed on that. My personal relationship there is okay, it's not great, but it could be better, but at least I know that I'm fixed on that and I can look there. And my local circles are great, and my church circles are great. Can I ask you to do something for me? Could you stand up? And could you very, very loosely form yourselves into circles? This won't take you long. Just look inwards as a circle. So let's have a circle here. Let's have a circle here and a circle there. Okay. Do you want to? Okay, if you can see anybody next to you that isn't in a circle, invite them in. Right, now, just take a moment to feel that circle and to look around at each other in that circle. Okay. Now, that feels pretty intimate at this stage, right? Perhaps more intimate than you thought you were going to be. I can promise you we're not going to get any more intimate than that. Now, what I'd like you to do now is, standing where you are, turn so that you're facing outwards. All of you are facing outwards. Right. Does that dynamically feel different to you? How does it feel?
Completely different.
Completely different. In what way?
I've got very little sense that there's anybody else here.
Right. Okay. It's also a bit of a defensive posture, isn't it? You feel a bit like, you know, you could take that lot on, couldn't you? You could do them, couldn't you? Easy. I don't know about that. They look pretty crafty to me. Okay, you can sit down again. I really just did that. I sort of did it to remind you that you're here and we're awake and we're all talking to each other, right? But I also did it to remind you that those circles that we form, which feel cozy and intimate and supportive, can also be defensive. They're also ways of buttressing ourselves against the rest of the world. Now, let's imagine that we've got a concentric circle of a particular kind of Christian over here. Let's say liberals. Let's say British liberals. And then we've got British evangelicals, British Catholics, British Pentecostals. And some people have got mixtures in their concentric circles, in their own circles. They go in between those things. But all of those circles, people in those circles are all looking towards what they perceive to be the source of their faith. They're all feeling like they've got that personal connection. Every single one of us creates our concentric circles by being selective about what we believe and feel about the institutions that we're part of. So if you take the arguments in the Church of England over women, over sexuality, over money, take your pick, really, over the last 500 years, people will often say, yes, but this is about my personal relationship with Jesus. It's about my personal relationship with my church. Those things are fine. What's happening here, to some degree, is that we're turning ourselves off to the things that trouble us about the institutions that we're in. We're creating a great big dam behind us, is the way I like to think of it. And in my case, ordinarily, if I was in a good place, I'd stick Donald Trump and the bishop's inadequacies behind that dam. And I'd say, the source is what matters to me, and my local community is what matters to me. Throw it over the wall. So you've got this great wall of stuff. What's behind that wall? Well, let's be honest, for Christians, there's quite a lot behind that wall, isn't there? If you go all the way back through all the history of the church, let me put it to you this way. We like to think that we speak truth to power. We like to think that we follow the precepts of Jesus in speaking truth to power and declaring, for example, that the first shall be last and the poor should be clothed and fed. And very often we do that. But behind that wall is a bunch of stuff that the church over the centuries has not just passively allowed to happen, but has actively engaged in. Behind that wall is the Spanish Inquisition. Behind that wall is the conquest of various different countries and the subjugation of the people there, both in the name of God and by the gun. Behind that wall is the treatment of women over the centuries. Behind that wall is the treatment of people with a different kind of sexuality to the one that the church believes in. Behind that wall is persecution. Behind that wall is a blind eye to child abuse. Behind that wall is all of the times when the church has actively allowed itself to be involved in supporting and creating power structures. In this country, 500 years of the church, the crown, and the state working together to create a uniform British, or English and British state based on the idea of one God, one church, one people. There's tons of other stuff, right the way down to how annoying your vicar is, right? Not just national, it's not just international, global, historic. It's also, you really don't like the coffee. And so behind that wall is all of that stuff. And that's the state that I was in, myself, in August, when I caught a sickness bug from my daughter, Grace, her name is. And she had one of those 24-hour vomiting bugs. And so I got up in the middle of the night to be sick, as you would, and discovered at that point that I have this thing about blood pressure where when I stand up, the blood pressure goes to my feet and it all goes wrong. And I pitched forward and I hit my head on the edge of the radiator, sharp edge of the radiator. For those who can see the lights, there's a kind of Harry Potter scar there, which was really difficult because I was interviewing the illustrator for the Harry Potter books the following week, and I had to kind of say to him, this is not a tribute. It's not some kind of weird Stanislavski kind of interview. And I hit my head really hard, really hard. And when I woke up, there was blood all over the place. It was like an abattoir. And at which point, some of you will be thinking, oh, that explains why he's gone off on a tangent now. But actually, I thought I'd broken my neck. I thought I'd broken my back. I was in hospital for a while. And in that state afterwards, with actually nothing was broken, it was just concussion and strained muscles. But for the next couple of months, I was forced to be indoors, really. Forced to be quiet, and you know, you feel a bit sort of vulnerable after a thing like that. You know, you feel a bit withdrawn. You don't necessarily want to be out there with people. You just want to sit and think and ponder where you are. And I learned a couple of things. One, which I kind of, I guessed, I think, but I learned it from personal experience, which is that death is really easy. It would have been in this case. The doctor at the hospital said, told me to stop moaning the following morning as I clawed at the neck brace. He said, the last one I had of those was in a coma and the one before that is dead. And I realized that I would have slipped into whatever the next state is, if there is one, with very little fuss. I just would have fallen over. I wouldn't know much about it. And it would have been a catastrophe for everybody around me. But not for me. And somehow, as somebody who spent their whole life being afraid of dying, I found that, and I find that comforting. But that's a whole other evening to talk about that. What I did see as I lay there at home is I saw the Trump thing happen. Now, the fact of the matter is that Donald Trump has been elected in America, as I said before, partly on the basis of an 81% support level among white evangelicals. And there are certain individuals, Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, who have helped that to happen. And they have actively been saying, this man is God's instrument. A racist preacher of hate is God's instrument. I firmly subscribe, I've read my Bible, I firmly subscribe to the idea that anybody can be used by God, okay? There's some pretty villainous people. You would ask the great King David, for example, a few questions about his private life. But to be saying in this time and place that Donald Trump is an instrument of God's will and that God has given his blessing to what is straightforward racism and hate preaching seems to me, from my perspective, to be utterly wrong. Alongside that, over that same period of time, was the discussion within the Church of England about what to do with the problem of same-sex relations. I don't want to go into it in great detail here tonight, except to say that what the bishops decided to do was a fudge, and the church is out of step drastically. Well, church leadership is drastically out of step with the rest of society, and many members of the clergy on the ground trying to minister to people are just baffled by the idea that you should say, yes, your faithful, monogamous, long-term relationship, which is lovely and puts many a straight marriage in the shade, is invalid or less worthy under God. It's baffling. Now, you know, I'm aware, as I say this, that there's going to be people in here who will profoundly disagree on both those things. There will be people here who are Trump supporters, perhaps. There'll be people here who would say that they hold to what they consider to be the biblical tradition on marriage. We can talk about that another night. We can talk about that till the cows come home, frankly. What I'm talking about here, though, is a personal response. For other people, it's other issues. I know a clergyman, for example, who found that the straw that broke his back in terms of the church was the fact that the Quran was read in Chichester Cathedral. Was it Chichester? What? Was it Glasgow? Yeah. Okay, a cathedral. And for him, that was the thing that cracked the dam. You see where I'm coming from? For him, personally speaking, all of the things that he put behind him in order to focus on his personal relationships and his concentric circles, all of those things came flooding over him when this one issue cracked his dam. He just couldn't take it anymore that day. And so the dam bursts, the water floods in, and with the water, as we know, in dams comes a hell of a lot of crap, which is all the stuff that we talked about before, Inquisition, slavery, oppression, all of that stuff that until now you've not been thinking about the church having been complicit in. And suddenly, you're up to your waist in water and crap, and you're wondering what to do about it. That's where I found myself in the autumn. Many people would say, well, you should have got to that position quite a lot sooner if you'd done a bit more studying of church history. But my point is that regardless of what you know or you don't know, in order to have those circles of support, you have to put that stuff behind you. And then sometimes, whatever your personal collection is, it overwhelms you. And then, in terms of being members of churches, in terms of being Christians, in terms of being Christians in this day and age, you find yourself with a conundrum. Because then it starts to feel, Star Wars analogy coming up, that all this time we've been thinking of ourselves as rebels for love and justice, when it turns out we've been living on the Death Star. What do you do? What do you do? Do you allow yourself to be swept away by the water and the crap? Never darken the door of a church again? Give up on the inspiration and the source and leave it be? Find your own way? Do you wade through the water hoping not to drown? Or do you stop and confront the crap and say, I've got to do something with this? I've got to name it for what it is, and I've got to find a way forward. The good news is, that it's not just us. The good news is that this clearly happens to people of every faith and creed in the world at some point. I could call as a witness all of those Muslims who are really angry and sick of being told that they personally should apologize for ISIS, when in fact they're carrying out their faith in a peaceful and compassionate and creative way, and as fully functioning citizens. And it began to feel to me like we were being hugely hypocritical, because quite a lot of those Christians who are supporting Trump are the ones who are saying to Muslims, you ought to apologize for ISIS. So whoever you are, whether you're a Muslim, a Christian, an atheist, a member of the Socialist Workers' Party, a Hindu, a Jew, a Jain, a Baha'i, whatever you are, at some point, this thing is going to happen to you. Can I just ask, just by nods of the head, are there people in this room who recognize that scenario? Okay, thank you. What are we going to do about it? When I was on the radio this morning with Martin, Emily Jeffrey, who was the presenter, heard what I had to say about all this and said, well, there are clearly going to be more questions than there are answers tonight, aren't there? Yep. Yep, there are. But on the other hand, I do think that there are things that we can do. We can think about, for example, in confronting the crap, things Jesus never said. I know you've had Nadia talking about the Beatitudes, the things that Jesus did say. I wrote down, off the top of my head, some things that Jesus didn't say. Jesus never said, we're going to make Nazareth great again. Jesus never said, vote Trump. He never said, vote Hillary. He never said, vote anybody. Jesus never said, suck up to presidents, kings, and queens. Jesus never said, conspire with the law and the crown to keep control of your nation. As I discussed, these are things that the church can easily be accused of doing. Jesus never said, burn heretics. Jesus never said, drown wise women. Jesus never said, keep state secrets. Jesus never said, kill foreigners. Jesus never said, torture dissidents. Jesus never said, go to war. Jesus never said, there is such a thing as a just war. Jesus never said, keep slaves. Jesus never said, white is right and black is animal. Jesus never said, sex is dirty. Jesus never said, your love doesn't count because you do it different. Jesus never said, I do. Not in the marriage context. I'm sure he did in other ways. Would you like a cup of tea, Jesus? Jesus never said anything about gay marriage. Jesus never said, make the little children suffer. Jesus never said, if you find child abuse, hide it. Jesus never said, some of you should become priests and the rest can take it easy. Jesus never said, build churches. Jesus never said, make as much money as you can from property to pay your pensions. Jesus never said, wear fancy clothes. Make fake crowns and call them mitres. Jesus never said, worship me. Jesus never said, bow down to me. Jesus never said, I am the destination. Jesus said, I am the way. Come to the Father through me. Jesus never said, you've got to become a Christian. He wanted to be a better Jew. And here's something that we really do, if we're to survive, have to think about. We are not, despite what we're told perpetually by the church, we are not Christians, first and foremost. That is not what Christ says. What he's doing is teaching us how to be better humans. Because, and this is a bombshell dropped not just by me, but by Desmond Tutu, whose word I think we can take, God is not a Christian. He said, Tutu said, God is not upset. He was asked about Gandhi. God is not upset that Gandhi was not a Christian, because God is not a Christian. All of God's children and their different faiths help us to realize the immensity of God. Jesus never said, this is an exercise. This that we're talking about here is not theology. It's real. It's my life and your life. Because if God is real, then God is real here and now. It's too important to be left to mere churches. Now, I'm not seeking to dismiss the divinity of Christ. Don't get me wrong. All religions are not the same. But I will tell you this story, which may be familiar to some of you. And it comes from Rumi, the Sufi master. Once upon a time, there were six blind men who lived in a village in India. And one day, the villagers told them, hey, there's an elephant coming to the village today. They had no idea what an elephant was. And so they decided, even though they couldn't see it, that they would go and feel it. And they all went. And the first one to go and feel the elephant put his arms around the elephant and said, this is really strong. It's really strong and substantial, like the trunk of a tree. And another went up here, said, no, it's not like the trunk of a tree. It's like the branch of a tree. Yeah, it's got this kind of branch shape. And the one over here was going, no, it's like the trunk of a tree. I can feel it. And one of them was going, no, hang on. No, it doesn't feel like a trunk. It doesn't feel like a branch. It feels like a sail that you get on a boat. It's like a sail. And the fifth one over here was going, I don't know what you're talking about. It's like a wall. It's like a big, solid wall. And the sixth one saying, you guys are crazy. You must be deluded. What I can feel, this elephant, an elephant is a smooth, long, sharp thing. It's like a pipe. Rumi's obvious point was that they were all looking at an elephant. They were all telling the truth. They were all being true to the full realization of what it is that they knew. The leg was exactly like a tree trunk. The trunk was like a branch. And I'm not, as I say, seeking to diminish the divinity of Christ and that claim, but it must be true, mustn't it? That if Christ is pointing to a God who is within and without nature and time, eternally true and cosmic in reach, but involved in the world we experience, then that God, however she, he, or they are named by people, must by definition be universally true. So much so that, as the psalm says, heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. So God is there and God is true. And if that is true, then God is there for everyone. Regardless and despite those who seek to build their power structures around their notion of him. And don't we just long for that to be true? I don't come here tonight as somebody who knows whether it's true or not. I don't come here actually as somebody who knows any answers at all. I come here as somebody who turned down this invitation because he didn't feel that he had any answers left, but who's come anyway to say, you know what? Some of us are asking this question, and it may just be the beginning of our understanding if we start to ask these questions and we go forward from here in honesty and humility and community. Because we do have a primal longing for home, for hope, for someone to see us down in the mud and take our hands and lead us home, for the darkness to lift, for the morning to come. And I want to pause just before I finish to play that clip of the song again, Dave, if we could. And this time, sitting down, taking it easy, being where you are, being yourself, I would invite you to listen, and if you want to sing along, hum along. If you want to join in singing this with me as an expression of our mutual longing for truth and clarity and home, then I would invite you to do that as we listen to the song. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. For they so persecuted the prophets who were before you. And you and I will take different things from the story of Jesus. As I said, I was born into a different tradition. I've stumbled into this one, but it seems to me to be the one that I have, the one that makes sense, the one that points to God, the one that invites me to come through Jesus to find God. So it's the one that I sit with, the one I can't get rid of, even though I want to, even though the church baffles and annoys me and hurts me. But in the Jesus that I read about, I see something different. There's a bunch of Christians in America who call themselves red-letter Christians. And that comes from in certain versions of the Bible, the words of Jesus are picked out in red. And their definition, let me just find it for you.
The goal of Red Letter Christians is simple: to take Jesus seriously by endeavoring to live out his radical countercultural teachings as set forth in Scripture, especially embracing the lifestyle prescribed in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus calls us away from the consumerist values that dominate contemporary America. He calls us to meet the needs of the poor. He calls us to be merciful, which has strong implications in terms of war and capital punishment. After all, when Jesus tells us to love our enemies, he probably means we shouldn't kill them. I love the stories of Jesus overturning the temple tables, the guy who breaks the rules by healing people on holy days, who treats outcasts like lepers, like human beings who are loved, who steps right in front of a fevered crowd, possibly about this size, of people with sharp stones in their hands, who are about to murder a woman who's been caught in adultery, which at that time could as easily have meant that her husband had been unfaithful, steps right in front of them and says, "Yeah, go on then. If you'd never done anything wrong," I'm paraphrasing, "throw the first stone. Let he who is without sin throw the first stone." He faces them down. He treats women as equals. He calls children to him and tells us to become like them. And in that, I see a call to playfulness, a call to community, a call to risk-taking, a call to compassion, to justice, to equality, to speaking truth to power, to opening yourself up to the presence of God here and now. And fine, we asked ourselves at the beginning, what do we do when we want to follow God, and Jesus is the figure that seems to want to lead us there, and that makes sense to us, but we can't abide the church. We don't want to wear that badge anymore. What can we do? What practically can we do? I want to explore those answers with you. But here are some things that seem to me to be obvious. First of all, we need community. Find somewhere to belong. We need to show compassion. So find some people who need help and help them. We need to see justice. So find a cause and fight for it. We need to see equality. So dare to treat all people as equals. And ask yourselves, do you really do that? Really? Do you really do that? We need to speak truth to power. Challenge your leaders. If you're up to your waist in water and crap, name it as crap and tell them it's crap. And tell them, in the words of my favorite verse of the Bible, Jesus wept over stuff like this. Study the source. Read, watch, discuss, contemplate your source. For those of us who follow the Christian tradition, it's Jesus. Open yourself up. Listen. Go out into nature. As we said before, all creation shall speak his name. Let it speak to you. And then look for the Spirit as it roams where it will. And wait for your morning to come. Where it roams, where it will. In the middle of the Somerset floods that happened a year or two ago, I was up to my neck, literally, in water and crap. Let me tell you, the metaphor came alive. And by my side, there was a guy called Ravi Singh from a charity, a Sikh charity based in Slough. And what the people of Somerset saw all around them were these wonderful, warm, generous Sikh guys also getting wet, lugging sandbags in and giving out food. Let us never, ever pretend or lie to ourselves as Christians or followers of Christ that we are the only ones who show compassion and we are the only ones who feed the poor and clothe the naked. Because we're not, because the Spirit of God will go where it will. And so finally, we'll have some questions, I think. But finally, let me ask you some questions. What if the kingdom of God was not where we think it is? What if God was not in church, or not just in church, and not even just in Christianity, the club we created in his name? What if Jesus didn't mean to create this at all? What if the church was not how we define it? What if it was the commonwealth of people of good faith, of all faiths and creeds, regardless of title or rank, all looking towards God and trying to live in that light? What if the Spirit of God was loose upon the earth? The inspiration, the unsettler, the upsetter, the fingertip brush of love, the rumor of glory. What if that Spirit refuses to be bound by our understanding and roams where it wants to? What if we opened up the possibility of meeting it anywhere? On the beach, on the mountain, in the pub, at the movies, in the middle of a gig, in your hospital bed, on the toilet, in a crowded room, in a storm, in the quiet, in a laboratory or an observatory, in church, in temple, in a mosque? How would that change us? What would that make us do? Where would it make us look? Within us and around us to see the morning coming. I don't know, but I look forward to exploring the answers with you. Thank you.
So we've got some time for some questions. Yeah, Jeannie.
I had an English teacher called Mr. Hemming. I think he was an atheist, and he gave me a quote which said, if God did not exist, man would find it necessary to invent him. What do you think about that?
Since I believe completely, wholeheartedly, that God exists, the question doesn't really arise.
But you said you were an atheist once.
Once. I tried to be an atheist. It didn't work. I didn't have enough faith.
Jane.
Thank you very much. I'm just playing with the kind of picture that you created of the wall, the kind of dam and the crap behind this dam. And then we have these kind of circles of belonging that are the other side of the dam. And it's quite that's quite a powerful image. But I'm just wondering if what behind that dam is the brokenness of being human. And by sort of creating that image of putting it behind the dam, we're not owning it, and it's somehow othering it. Well, in fact, that brokenness of being human is also in these circles of belonging. And we're not going to escape that brokenness. We're not going to be able to create this sort of nirvana in some sort of pure circle of belonging. It's still there. So I'm just wondering whether there's a danger with that image of othering the crap rather than us owning the crap in our circle.
I think that's really well put, and I think that's a fair point, and I should perhaps have expanded what I meant by confronting the crap. What I mean by confronting the crap is owning the crap. Because, yes, the church has made all these mistakes, so has every other human institution in the world ever. And in order to move forward in our brokenness, we need not to despise our history and our church for having done that, but only to accept that it was broken and we've made mistakes and we need forgiveness. So I think actually we need to pick up the crap, extending the metaphor, pick up the crap and rub it all over ourselves. You see, we don't own the thing. And say, yeah, all right, yeah. We want to talk about the Spanish Inquisition? We did that. That was us. And the reason why that stuff happens is because we're broken human beings who are trying to get to the source. And in the meantime, power plays and greed and all sorts of other things come into play and invade what we had hoped would be our precious space. So, yeah, own it. Thank you for making that point.
There's a model that we use, I talk about sometimes here, which was a John Wimber thing originally, which gets rid of the boundaries, the circles of belonging, and says actually it's not, we think of church as being, in mathematical terms, a bounded set, something that you're inside or outside of. And actually, it's better to think of